I saw on your bio that it said like skeptic as well. So I was like, oh, that's fun that's in there too. But I guess where are you? So where are you recording from though? Where do you,
this is actually the studio that we've built on my farm in an old pig barn that was first built in 1945.
Okay.
And we're broadcasting using Starlink. This is not a pump for Elon, but we have no internet. So we use Starlink commercial, and we have fiber that goes straight here from the studio all the way up to a home on the hill that has the satellite receiver.
Wow. Okay. So
that's really cool.
No, I mean, honestly, what I'm seeing from the quality of Starlink, it's looking pretty good on your end, actually.
We get occasional drops that are a little, you know, sometimes StreamYard. Well, that's what you're using. Yeah. So, StreamYard is a good tool when you have little drops like that, because then it can upload in the end for any glitches. So good choice
that's
on
really
you.
Good.
Yeah. Appreciate it. So let's go ahead and get started. I think most people will know already, as you've made kind of plenty of headlines at this point, that you're one of the original inventors of the mRNA technique that was used in COVID. Briefly, what would you say your main role in that is?
I was the person who originally came up with the idea and did the original proof of concept, wrote the original patent invention disclosure, and then wrote a series. I spent days together with a high-powered San Diego lawyer going over all the potential implications and applications. And that was the basis for the subsequent 9 patents. When I got into this, I was quite facile with making RNA, which is an art in and of itself, from tissues. And there was no standardized way to make large quantities of RNA, purify it. It wasn't really understood what elements, genetic elements, were necessary to make an RNA both stable and readily translated. And there was no common, efficient reporter system used. Now, I pioneered the use of luciferase for that, and that's still what Pfizer used, for instance. All the nuance of the structure of the thing, the importance of capping, and then the reduction to practice first in a myriad of cell lines, everything I could collect at the Salk Institute, then in frog embryos and chick embryos. And then when I left the Salk with a nervous breakdown and PTSD and joined a little startup company in Vical, they put me in a corner and made me a Skunk Works, and I carried on the work. And within about a month and a half, we had a series of other major discoveries that led to a science paper that involved the use of mRNA in the absence of any of these positively charged fats. And then that moved into my work with cloning and producing mRNA for proteins from the AIDS virus as immunogens, and then the initial work having to do with using mRNA vaccination strategy for influenza vaccines. That was all that package got sold to Merck, because it was not a core part of the Vical business plan. And the deal was that Merck scientists would get to take credit for what had been done by the Vical scientists. And so that's why you see the subsequent hype and publications coming out of Merck. It's a long, ugly biotech, you know, story that I've covered too many times already over the past 2 years, but that's the thumbnail version.
No, yeah. I won't try to press you into covering it once again, as I'm sure there's plenty of other podcasts and papers that we can read out there. Initially, the concept of the mRNA technique, what were the possibilities you foresaw it being used for? I believe I read that initially it was for cancer research.
No, wrong.
Was my understanding.
Wrong.
No, okay.
No, that's the storyline produced by the people that came about a decade after me, Carrico and Weissman, and had sought my advice when they launched that program. No, I was seeking to be, as a 28-year-old, seeking to become an MD gene therapist, working on the leading gene therapy technology at the time, retroviral vectors. And this was just a way to ask questions about how the RNA of a retrovirus gets packaged. And one thing led to another, and I found myself inadvertently doing non-viral gene therapy. And then because I was pretty rigorous about characterizing how much protein was being made, which the answer is very little, I became very aware that this was not going to be useful for any of the classic gene therapy applications. So what are you going to use it for? In a separate line of research, the postdoc that was mentoring me at the bench, Dan St. Louis, had an experiment involving transferring foreign genes into mice, and the mice would stop producing the foreign protein after about 2 weeks. I'm the one that figured out that the problem wasn't a genetic element, but rather it was the immune response against the foreign protein. And so with these two things in hand, when I had the data that showed that this was working very slightly, a very modest amount of gene polynucleotide transfer, RNA transfer, and protein expression, the obvious application was something that wouldn't require much protein. You were never going to cure cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy using this tech because it doesn't work good enough. And so having come, really, I cut my teeth in an AIDS lab beginning in 1983, the very beginning of AIDS, that then became a major focus in vaccine development. So I'm very familiar with vaccine development, familiar with the application space, had worked in influenza at Northwestern. And so when I filed the patent applications, the initial one was for using RNA as a drug in general, and then for using, among other things, for using RNA to produce an immune response in various animals. And that has a whole bunch of derivative applications having to do with monoclonal antibodies and, you know, therapeutics and all kinds of stuff. So that's where that all comes from. And at the same time, we filed patents on antisense RNA and circular RNAs and ribozymes. And there was a lot of stuff going on in the RNA world at the time. And because of this, I really found myself way out on the front edge. I was just in Stockholm 2 days ago reminded that I was called to visit the Karolinska in 94, I think it was, where I interacted with Dr. Peter Liljeström, who was a pioneer of self-replicating RNA, and we discussed all this. Peter sits on the Nobel Selection Committee, and he was the one that counseled me a couple of years ago that I really didn't have much to worry about with all of this effort to market Carrico and Weissman for the Nobel. He said that the committee had already looked into that and that wasn't going to happen. So that's, you know, it goes back a long way. I've been doing this for a long time and always been very aware of the limitations, but also the toxicity. The reason why I stopped working in catadink lipid delivery with RNA or DNA was because after synthesizing many, many different compounds, we have many other patents other than these 9 core patents, we could never overcome the toxicity in animals. And we assumed that it had been overcome when they deployed this, but in fact, it's quite clear now in retrospect that that was a false assumption. I'm choosing my words.
When you say deployed this, are you referring to the COVID-19 vaccines?
Correct.
Okay. Now, there's one that we can certainly talk about, and it's been hashed out over the past couple of years. So 2019, we get word from China that there's a virus that's spreading.
Symptoms. Yeah, that timeline is a little tricky. I could say for sure I got notified by Dr. Michael Callahan, who just put an op-ed in the New York Times, a former CIA officer who I understood to be in Wuhan at the time, called me on January 4th of 2020, telling me that we had a novel coronavirus that looked like it was going to be a public health problem. And in terms of when China was really aware of it officially, that's a little cloudy right now. But when it entered the population, that's also cloudy. And it certainly is remarkably coincident with Event 201. It's in the fall of 2019, if not earlier. And there's evidence suggesting that it may have entered the population even earlier than fall of 2019. So that whole timeline you just quickly clipped over, I think, is a great big hot mess, and that we may never get to the bottom of.
Oh, I don't doubt it. It'll be difficult to get to the bottom of it. I even have a friend who was in China in January, February of 2019, and said her whole family and them all came down with flu-like symptoms that lasted at least a week to 2 weeks. They couldn't pinpoint what it was. Medicine wasn't working. So when COVID-19 rolled around, when it actually made the global news, she wasn't very surprised about it originating from China, where she had been visiting. I don't know how close she was to Wuhan, and there's nothing to corroborate or back up what they were saying.
You would have to hope that she had some old bloods banked away somewhere, and then you could ferret that out. If you don't,
certainly would be a long shot on something like that.
Yeah, a very unlikely, mm-hmm. unlikely situation.
Now, the rollouts of the vaccines, it's been interesting to watch, because as one of the original creators of the mRNA technique, you've come out vocally against, mainly for children, I believe, because you yourself, I believe, is vaccinated. I think that was stated on the Joe Rogan.
Yeah, the focus on children was one of necessity. It was mm-hmm. quite clear to me that the horse had already left the barn on adult vaccination, and the propaganda campaign was quite mature. And there was already considerable acceptance of these products in the general adult population at the time when I really kind of did this is the hill that I'm going to die on statements. And so Jill and I and some of my other physician colleagues discussed all this, and you can't win every battle. You have to focus your efforts. And so we made a conscious decision to try to focus on the children as something that we had the time and potentially the access in terms of alternative media at that point to make an impact on that. And I think we did. Not mm-hmm. to pat myself on the back, but the uptake in children has been remarkably poor, as has the uptake of the bivalent product, I'll call it. And I take, there's a list of about 8 different reasons why people think I'm a mass murderer and have accused me of such. Of course, for having invented the technology, that's reason number one. There are those who assert that my activities have caused people to not take the vaccine, and therefore I'm a mass murderer. I personally see it the other way around.
So you're getting it from both sides then.
You have no idea.
Opposed to vaccine and those that are for it. It's based on you creating it and then turning away from it.
Yeah. There's, one of the reasons I'm a mass murderer apparently is because I endorsed Matthias Desmet's mass formation hypothesis or mass formation or
I wanted to ask you about that, because you mentioned it in your book, and I was wondering if you could kind of give us a brief overview of that.
Well, this was the 3 words that I mentioned on Joe Rogan that caused Google to lose their cookies, or I like to say Silicon Valley to lose bladder control. I said the words, and they immediately started trending. This is over a year ago. Remember, this was released mm-hmm. right around right. New Year's, and I think it was New Year's Eve, and there, as I discussed then and had in multiple prior podcasts, this is the work of Matthias Desmet. It's not my work. I'm a student of Matthias. I've met him. I've hung out with him. We've drunk wine together. I've visited his house, etc. We're buddies. But all that aside, I want to acknowledge it's not my work. It's not my theory. It's kind of important to me to give credit where credit's due.
Sure.
So Matthias is a clinical psychologist at University of Ghent, full professor. And one of the things he teaches about are these group psychosis phenomena that have existed all the way through history. I mean, a case could be made that Jesus Christ represented aspects of mass formation in terms of how the populace responded to him. Certainly Plato's Allegory of the Cave is another example. But in the more modern situation, and there's those who assert that Matthias invented this whole cloth and it has no background in psychology. But in fact, Sigmund Freud spoke about it. Joost Mullors, of course, is famous for his work in this area. And then Hannah Arendt, where she focused on totalitarianism and the rise of totalitarianism during the Nazi era, Hannah being a Jewish woman who was subjected to the Holocaust and then immigrated to the United States and is now recognized as one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, but was ostracized by the Jewish American community under the thesis that her explanation and scholarly work in mass formation and rise of totalitarianism was blaming the general populace for what had happened rather than blaming the perps, the Nazi propagandists, etc. And fascinatingly, modern Jewish community, some subsectors here in the United States, have raised exactly the same arguments against Matthias and have functionally made it so that I can't even hardly talk about it anymore. I get so much blowback. And that's the thesis that Matthias is blaming the common person for enabling the mass hypnosis that's occurred. By placing the blame on the common person, he is allowing the, quote, global predators to escape blame, and they continue to do their nefarious activities, which is resulting in additional mass deaths. So that is the logic of how come Matthias and I are mass murderers, just to nail that, hammer that nail down. The thesis is, and again, Matthias's work is really a 21st century extension of the work of largely Hannah Arendt in particular. And Matthias talks about it as such. He, as time progressed during the outbreak, here he is a specialist in this kind of phenomena, and he's not even aware that it's happening in the present. And suddenly he has a series of epiphanies where he realizes that he is living through the experience that he's been teaching most of his professional life. The thesis is that when a society begins to fragment socially, so that we all become isolated from each other. Of course, in the modern era, in 21st century, we have electronic tools that are really accelerating this process. So people become socially isolated. The typical obese young man in the basement of his parents' house is one stereotype, but it occurs all the way through our society. You can see the obsession over the cell phone and TikTok and all those things that keep us apart from each other. And when they become isolated like this, they become anxious. And there's a number of other factors that Matthias talks about, such as bullshit jobs, his term. And I can tell you in Belgium is full, where he works, is full of bullshit jobs. It's a socialist country, and the vast majority of the labor force essentially does non-productive work.
What type of jobs? Could you give an example?
Clerical in particular, all kinds of... stuff relating to the state in clerical activities, administrative activities, etc., is kind of what Matthias is. Things that don't give you a sense of value at the end of the day. You don't come home. Like, for instance, I used to be a carpenter, and I still am a farmer. And I can tell you, when I go out there and whack nails or put up a piece of fence or whatever, at the end of the day, I have a sense I did something, right? So this is the difference between the physicals and the virtuals, to read ahead to the modern synthesis that many people are promoting. So Matthias's thesis is people become isolated. They lose connection with the world around them. They develop free-floating anxiety because the world doesn't seem to make sense to them. They have lost their connectivity to other human beings and all the important social things that come with that. And then as they develop free-floating anxiety, that transforms into free-floating anger. I'm simplifying this. And then that anger, which, by the way, I sense it deeply right now. there is a lot of anger right now that's free floating, looking for something to direct itself towards as people are waking up to what the government has done to them. But you have these conditions, and when those happen, it becomes very easy for either some of organic, let's call it organic events, something that arises spontaneously within the population, or a directed event. In other words, some group may target an out-group. So notably, the Nazis used that strategy. And a case could be made that one of the organic predecessors that existed prior to the rise of the Nazi regime in Germany was, of course, hyperinflation. And my Bitcoin buddies love to make the case that in almost every one of these major events, they've been preceded by a period of hyperinflation, which causes people to lose faith in the society because the very underpinnings of society seem to be no longer working. And so when these conditions arise, then it's easy for a population to become fixated on one thing. It will relieve their stress. They're having all this internal angst from what they're experiencing, their fear. Nothing can be resolved. And then an event happens, or an individual or a group are targeted, and suddenly they have a thing to fixate their anxiety on. And they become obsessed about this. And when this happens, that can be manipulated and directed. And a case could be made, if you want to go down conspiracy lane, that the COVID-19 COVID crisis absolutely fits in a playbook that involves, sounds like somebody's dog is objecting to Sonic.
He's objecting to the probably a fire siren.
when this happens, people can be powerfully manipulated and are readily basically hypnotized. If you bombard them with messaging, they will become fixated on that messaging and on the scapegoat that is identified. And we saw this working in the PSYOPs. You know, again, to this all weaves together. We have all been subjected to 3 years of military-grade PSYOPs using technologies, information warfare technologies, fifth-generation warfare technologies that were designed for the fourth-generation incursion forces like in Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. You know, the tech that was designed to resist those insurgencies, which I make the case the United States military has never won one of those insurgency battles. We could argue about Nicaragua. That tech that was designed to manipulate the thought, emotion, minds of adversaries, foreign adversaries, was deployed throughout in particular, the Five Eyes Alliance, which is Great Britain, United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, to control information and control the thoughts and beliefs of people to get them to accept a unlicensed medical product, you know, accept, compel, and then eventually coerce and mandate. So, you know, all the precursors were there. You can see them in retrospect. These technologies, military-grade technologies, were deployed. And I just to kind of cap this thread off, because it weaves into both of these issues, and it's kind of important right now, in my opinion. There is a school of thought, a tendency to hate those that have persecuted, let's say, those of us that are awake, those of us that were resistant to the mask mandates and the lockdown mandates and the jabs, forced jabs, all that kind of stuff. And you know who these people are. I mean, Lena Wen is a poster child. So is Peter Hotez. Much of the entertainment elite were paid to do this. a few pieces of silver, and they're going to have to live with that the rest of their lives. But this was done to people using advanced military grade capabilities, as we see in the Twitter files, all the censorship, everything. And some people were able to resist it or wake up from it. And good on them. Many people were not. And should we hate them because they have succumbed to military-grade psyops that was perpetrated on them? I argue no. I'm not saying that we should forgive Tony Fauci or Deborah Birx or Lena Wynne, for that matter. But I am saying that for your mother, your uncle, your coworker, the poor soul, the expat Californian that's in the grocery line with their nose funnel on, we don't have to hate them. They're victims. And if we take that attitude, then we can have an open heart and try to share truth with them and bring them over. Because we're never going to bring them over that persuadable middle if we approach them with hate. So that's the end of my rant on that.
Right. I think you made a good distinction, though, between like your aunt and your uncle and then someone like Dr. Fauci, who was very involved in pushing this enough to say that he was the science. A very, very bold
statement. I'm convinced that Tony Fauci is highly likely to be a deep intelligence community. People grossly underestimate who he is and what he represents. He has been managing. The reason why I got the big boost in salary that everybody likes to talk about is because he took over the whole DOD biodefense enterprise. He basically made a case to Congress and the executive branch that the DOD were a bunch of klutzes after the anthrax attacks, and that the NIH and NIAID in particular was so much better at product development and managing these things that all those funds ought to be transferred over under his control. The DOD, by the way, has not forgotten about that. But that's what he is. He is the king. He has been the kingpin. He's been the czar of the entire biodefense enterprise across both HHS and DOD and the intelligence community. I've dealt with a lot of intelligence agencies, agents over the years. They are trained liars. They're very adroit at lying. And Tony Fauci shows all the signs.
It's so weird, though, because when I look at him, he seems, and this is just kind of my perspective, he seems pretty arrogant, like right off the bat.
You think?
So to me, it's not really difficult to be like, maybe this guy would lie, but I'm going to ask you a question and you can decide whether or not you want to answer it. But Tony Fauci, like, he stepped down. Do you have any idea why he would do that? Like, given what you've kind of said,
I think that, we may never know. I guarantee Tony didn't give up power, because he wanted to spend more time with his family. It may be that he has an upward path for additional power with World Health Organization or Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm speculating. He could have, there could be eight different ways from Sunday why Tony decided that was the time to jump. And one of those, and it could be a sum of many of those reasons. And I suspect that things were getting so hot in the kitchen that it was just getting time for him to quietly, as best as possible, scoop up his winnings from Rick's Cafe and move on to the next casino.
Yeah, I guess you probably won't ever really know, but I did find it very interesting. But Connor, I know there were some more things that you wanted to get into. Maybe a little bit of something about Project Veritas.
Timing of this meeting is...
I'm doing nonstop hits on Veritas today. Today is Veritas.
Oh, we hate
day.
To make you repeat all of it, but we are very curious about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd be curious about your involvement with the interviews with Veritas. So they reached out to you leading up to them as they got this lead with Pfizer or after the fact?
So I'll just briefly cover the chain of events. Mm-hmm. Two nights ago, I landed in Dulles, coming back from Germany by way of Vienna and London. So I've been out for a week over in Europe. So we hit the tarmac about 10. We're home around 11 midnight or so. Wake up in the morning. And as I recall, about 10-ish, I get a ping from Veritas saying, Dr. Malone, would you be interested in giving us a comment on our latest file? I have a warm place in my heart for any freedom fighter at this point, and I always say yes to mm-hmm. something like that. And I do what I can to support Veritas because I think they have acted with integrity and effectiveness. They do use honey trap technology that is not kind of how I like to do things, but that's James O'Keefe is quite clear on that. There's in their world, they have to deceive in order to catch deceptors. That's just the Faustian bargain that he has chosen. It's not my style, but it's what Veritas does, and they've been very successful. In this case, it was a male, identifying as a male, just to get California on you. I think he probably used the pronoun he, I know he did. He apparently is an ex-Pfizer employee. And it would appear that he was able to engage with this worldwide director of mRNA strategy for Pfizer.
James Tristan, is that right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of chatter. Everything about him has been
Jordan Tristan Walker.
Everything about him has been scrubbed on the internet. Even the Wayback Machine has been cleaned.
Really?
Yep. And that happened within hours. That's a fascinating secondary story. I get the call and the email. I chat them up and say, yeah, what can I do for you? And they send me a link to a embargoed video clip. And so I view that. I'm stunned. We do a Zoom hit, which they record, and then that's the highly edited commentary that is included from me in that overall production. Then they ask if I will sit in on their Twitter spaces starting at 9 last night, and I sat in until 11. Having my brain somewhere over the Atlantic, I was kind of like, I got to go to bed, guys. Very active discussion. Over 17,000 people, I'm understanding, was on that Twitter space call. So that's one of the largest ones that I've been in. Of course, it drops at about 7:30 that night. I had done my best to kind of promote that something was going to drop. It was embargoed, so I couldn't say what. I got a call from Steve Kirsch, who's trying to pick my brain, as he does from time to time. He really wanted to get out of me what was in it, and I was like, no, Steve, I'm sorry, but it's embargoed.
You resisted.
You're going to have to watch the video same time everybody else does.
He thought he could get the inside scoop, bless him.
But, Steve is a friend, but he can he's a little hungry from time to time.
Understandable.
So he has a man on a mission, by God. My assessment, I'm asked to give my initial reactions on very short notice. I just barely watched the video. Mm-hmm. So I give my personal gut reactions, which are coming from a place of shock at the, psychological profile of what I've encountered, not just the content. Mm-hmm. This individual, there are characteristics displayed. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'm just a physician, but they appear to fit some descriptions and profiles of either sociopath or psychopath. This complete lack of empathy, this kind of giggling joy, having to do with the hardship of others. For me, as I watch this, I'm familiar with the personality type. This kind of arrogant, elitist, pharmaceutical and molecular virology developer person is a profile that's very familiar with me. I've dealt with it in academia my whole career. I don't like these people very much. It's part of the reason why I migrated to having my own consulting company, because running a small consulting shop is not the way to make big bucks, but you can fire your clients. So you can kind of control your space, and you don't have to. I love this book from a professor at the Harvard Business School, the title of which is The No Asshole Rule. And so that's kind of how I've run my consulting shop for a long time, is not letting these kind of people into my life. But this is clearly an example of someone, a young physician, full of hubris, with apparently no moral compass, spouting off incredible things with evidently very little understanding of immunology. As I said, apparently no moral compass. And he appears to reflect the corporate culture within which he is embedded. I suspect that is very much the case. So those are the reactions I gave to them. They clipped them up, added to the overall video, deployed that, then the Twitter spaces, and then I woke up at 5 this morning because I'm still on Swedish time, and just the hits haven't stopped. It's a full day of recording.
Yeah, for those who might not have seen this video, is there like a very brief description about what this guy was admitting to?
He was quite gleefully bragging that Pfizer has completely captured the U.S. regulatory apparatus and the FDA through the revolving door mechanism, that this is the norm throughout the entire government, these regulatory affairs people immediately seek employment in pharma, and that's normal, and that's just the way things are. He was bragging about, in quite lengthy detail, about the ongoing, both the planned and apparently ongoing studies that Pfizer is performing involving what is gain of function research, but using the euphemism of directed evolution. This appears to be the same kind of word game that Tony Fauci used in his testimony, in which famously he was called a liar by a senator. And he speaks about the fact that COVID is going to be great for Pfizer profits for the foreseeable future. He speaks about engineering new viral variants. Basically, what he says is that Pfizer is doing exactly the same thing that happened in the Wuhan Institute of Virology to generate new mutants and identify them and then potentially build new vaccines in a way that would allow them to anticipate the circulation of those variants in the general population. And there's the one might, Kim.com, let's just put a pin on it, inferred that this seemed to imply that Pfizer was engineering the virus, releasing it, and then providing the cure, the ideal business loop. And I can understand why he might jump to that. I don't see, that's just such a sensitive topic that I don't want to speculate without any evidence, direct evidence, receipts, because it's so explosive. But the gentleman does seem to imply that this would be the ideal business model, the ideal cash cow, uses those words. And he also makes a statement that's very curious, that what Pfizer has been doing has been very good for Pfizer. but not good for the country. It leaves the whole thing leaves you with many people have a sense of this can't possibly be true. This must be a setup. Veritas must have been set up, because there's no way that a senior Pfizer executive would glibly spill out these, mm-hmm. you know, apparent atrocities, crimes against humanity, in such a casual fashion. Yet, I can assure you, Veritas did the due diligence. And there is an additional video drop that will come out later today in which James O'Keefe, apparently on camera, confronts this gentleman directly about his employment at Pfizer, which is confirmed, mm-hmm. and other aspects of this. And apparently, if you believe O'Keefe, and I don't think he's likely at this point to be hyping things. He's already got one of the biggest stories on the planet at the moment. He seems to think that these additional videos that are about to drop are even more stunning in terms of the gentleman's response to his being confronted. And then, of course, as we were discussing earlier, somehow Google, as they did with when I said mass formation psychosis, has been actively editing search results in apparently in a manual fashion all the way through this. There's a number of screenshots that people have captured that are amazing. The gentleman's social media in virtually his entire history, which many people have grabbed, undergraduate at Yale, MD from Baylor, with all the trimmings. Mm-hmm. He seems to have been completely scrubbed from the internet within hours, including all the way back through the Wayback Machine, which suggests to me, I infer, that this is more evidence of the tight collusion and collaboration that exists between Pfizer and Google. Another thing that occurred was the Daily Mail in the UK put out an article summarizing the Veritas findings and then almost immediately deleted it. Pfizer is really a division of a very large investment firm functionally. And is tightly integrated in a horizontal way with Reuters. So no surprise that the Daily Mail would immediately drop this and delete their article. You have to go back to Wayback Machine or other archive services to find the article, but it's been grabbed and people have posted it. Corporate media is just... if you want to see the power of Pfizer, look at what has happened to all the evidence around this story. It's just being flushed, scrubbed. Mm. This is the memory hole process that George Orwell predicted. And that's why books are so important, as Steve Bannon points out. They may end up being our only historic record. I wrote an essay yesterday about Speaking for the Dead in which I referred to the archives being dusty tomes and obsolete solid-state drives in some future. I think that's, we all believe that the internet is forever, and we believe that the Wayback Machine is our portal to the past. The Wayback Machine Group has agreed with the U.S. government to operate with input from the intelligence community to delete records that are considered sensitive. They deleted records about the Hunter Biden laptop stories. And then when those became apparently true, they were caught putting them back in.
Interesting that it feels like we need archive machines and sites for the archive.
Yeah. Who owns the archive machines? This is one of the other paradoxes. This is why it's so important, by the way, this lawsuit against Google to break its ad monopoly. Mm-hmm. Google completely controls the advertising market, which is why there's just no oxygen for the likes of you. You've probably seen that little clip where it compares a conservative podcaster and a progressive podcaster in terms of their sponsorship. And it's a comedy clip, but you know the progressive sponsor is saying, "Oh, and Pfizer, and you know, and, this and that, all yeah. these big, you know, Coca-Cola, these big corporate names," and the conservative podcaster is selling structured water and coffee,
and ExpressVPN, pretty much every single conservative,
yeah,
ExpressVPN.
And merch,
pretty much,
yeah. So yeah. The amazing thing to me is how much of this was predicted by Huxley and Orwell in Brave New mm-hmm. World and 1984.
Yeah. I mean, I believe there's nothing new under the sun. You know, these types of things will keep happening.
But there is. Fifth generation warfare is some screwy, bizarre new stuff. I mean, if you get into it, and I strongly advise, it's not covered in the book. It's something that we've kind of worked into subsequently. So many people think we should have had it as the closing chapters, but Skyhorse Publishing, when we turned the book in, it was twice that long. And
because this is already like super thick, by the way.
And you'll notice it's highly referenced. I'm not putting in a bunch of speculation about, you know, what I think Klaus Schwab eats for breakfast. It's highly detailed and it's highly referenced and cited, but it was quite a bit longer and they really hacked and slashed it to get down to that. Tony Lyons' comment was, well, at this length, it'll make a great doorstop, but nobody's going to read it.
Well, that means there's going to be a second book, right? Because you have to
fit
all the rest.
The problem is that everything is moving so fast. That we thought we would take the chapters that were deleted and put them out as a supplement. And now it's like everything, all of that stuff, who would read it in the face of the essays we're putting out today? But it was Fifth Gen Warfare that I lectured on in Stockholm, and it woke some of those people up. I didn't pull my punches, and I strongly recommend that your viewership invest the time, get Michael Flynn's new book, get the book 5GW. It has nothing to do with cell towers. That's you can get as a Kindle book on Amazon. Our Substacks, which you don't have to pay for, you can just read, you know, and a good one to start with, if you want to just kind of bend your mind wide open, is the article that I put out, Twitter is a Weapon, Not a Business. And if you work yourself through that one, you'll understand that Arab Spring was nothing like what you thought it was. And then there's a lot of, I think there's five or six that we put out now, and that is going to be a component of the book that we're working on right now.
Yeah. No, we encourage our audience, because we're called Resident Skeptics, so we encourage our audience to try to look at things for themselves and
good
come to
you.
Their own conclusion.
I argue that is the single thing that will protect us in this generation and the future. People have got to stop being intellectually lazy. They have to think for themselves. They have to triangulate truth. And the rise of independent media, the alternative media, is breaking the back of corporate media. That's sure as hell my mission. In addition to protecting children, and now, frankly, speaking for the dead and injured, is doing what I can to take out corporate media and their stranglehold on information and thought. That has got to stop. And unfortunately, you know, Matthias's work, the lessons of history are that it's only about 10 to 15% of people that really want to be free. And that's just a harsh reality. Being free is wicked hard. I mean, if you, for instance, just take the example, we get the question all the time about the vaccine schedule, the child vaccine schedule. And just to use that as an example, because everybody, you know, that is awake is busy going, okay, if they've done that with COVID vaccines, what the heck did they do with all these other vaccines they're trying to jab into my, you know, newborn? Like hepatitis B for a sexually transmitted and blood transmitted disease, right?
Yeah.
Or human papillomavirus. You know, people are starting to question the whole enterprise, and we get this all the time. Here's the thing, is an illustration of the challenge of being a sovereign person. Decide that you are going to take ownership for making the decisions about vaccinating your children, which vaccines to give them and when. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is, I do not trust the state to make those decisions. I'm going to have to make those decisions myself, because the state, I've come to the conclusion, this is what most people's path is, I've come to the conclusion that the state is so corrupt that the decisions that they're making are not fair and balanced. They're skewed for a variety of reasons. And I can no longer trust them with the well-being of my child. So there are those in that community that say, I'm going to make my own decisions about what to jab and what not to jab. When you do that, you now assume responsibility, because it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
By not having your child vaccinated, they could end up with tetanus. They could end up, in theory, with measles or mumps. And then you have to ask the question, well, if they did, how severe is that going to be? And, you know, what are they going to be the consequences? And if you decide, oh, of these things, I think the MMR vaccine absolutely is one that I should give my child, and I should give it to him good and hard and frequent, like the current schedule. And let's say your son or daughter develops what appears to be brain inflammation as one of the driver symptoms. And suddenly they have a personality change, their learning curve flattens out, they're not speaking and learning as quickly, and you're gonna have to live with that. It's a very dicey situation where you're saying, I assume responsibility for my actions and the consequences, because I do not trust the state to do that and make that.
Well, we might have lost connection to the servers there for a minute. Let's see if Dr. Malone comes back on.
Yeah, I think that might have been a drop on your side, but I'm not sure. In any case,
sure either. We both dropped.
We'll take the blame. We'll take the full blame
we'll
for it.
We'll take it.
But I mean, we're pretty
so
close.
So
we're
where we were at was, if you choose to be a sovereign person and make those decisions.
It might be StreamYard.
The gremlins just do not want us to talk about.
I know, that's what I was thinking. I was like, maybe
really trying
is
hard
trying to
here.
Stop us. We'll let you close off real
you know,
quick, though.
You got
to
own it. Or you can just transfer the responsibility to the state and just take it whichever way it comes. And I think it's a great metaphor for what it means to be a sovereign person and assume that responsibility for yourself and your family. As far as I'm concerned, there is no other way to live. I've spent too many years on small farms, and I'm ruined. I think that's increasingly the challenge we all face. Do you want to have do you want to own nothing and be happy? Do you want to live in a command economy run by a group of oligarchs that like to have a bacchanal every winter in Davos? Or do you want to build your own community and live as a free person? And most people would rather be told what to do, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, and I think this is where we're going to end, because I think that's sweet. That's good right there.
I guess a perfect ending.
Yeah. And we'll put everything that you've talked about, we'll put in the description for our viewers. But Dr. Malone, We really appreciate the time that you've given us and your insight. And best of luck with all the stuff that's going on, and with especially with Project Veritas. And I'm sure there's a lot coming your way, good and bad.
I'm sure you got a few busy weeks ahead of you as this continues.
Yep. Well, thanks for reading the book. And let me close on one thing that is a message I've been giving out a lot. None of us have to be victims. Even if you're vaccine injured like I am, you do not have to identify as vaccine injured. You don't have to be a victim. They may have victimized us, but you don't have to be a victim. You can be a warrior. You can choose to resist. You can choose to work for a better future. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the only choice to make, but it's your free choice.
Love it. Agree. Dr. Malone, thank you so much for your time.
Be good.
Thank you very much.